on air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Heavy rain across the state welcomed by farmers.
So the rain varied a little bit from one end of Sheffield to the other, only about 5 or 6 mil the difference, but we got roughly about 66 mil at home. And on the back of the 28 mil we got a couple of weeks ago, it's certainly going to make a difference. The grass had greened up significantly from the last little rain we had, and this will hopefully get us a bit of growth.
And fears that dairy farmers will have to euthanise thousands of calves on farm in spring.
It's not something that farmers, you know, want to do and need to do. It's a necessity at present, and that's in the unfortunate part. And I don't think it's something you ever get used to doing.
More on that confronting story in a little while. But first, we're going to talk rain. So if you've got a rain gauge and you can get a reading to us, send us a text on 0438 922 936. I'd love to hear about how much rain there is in your area. Sounds like there's been quite a bit up in the northwest around the Sheffield area, and it's coming down south and down the east, but still falling. The northwest appears to be getting the bigger falls, leaving farmers with a spring in their step and a quick reprieve from the dry conditions they've faced over spring and summer. Scott Frankham farms in the Sheffield area.
So the rain varied a little bit from one end of Sheffield to the other, only about 5 or 6 mil the difference, but we got roughly about 66 mil at home. And on the back of the 28 mil we got a couple of weeks ago, it's certainly going to make a difference. The grass had greened up significantly from the last little rain we had, and this will hopefully get us a bit of growth.
What was Sheffield looking like, and how much difference do you think this is going to actually make?
Oh, Sheffield was looking very, very dry. I actually do a bit of livestock agency work as well for elders in the area, and I got a lot of farmers that were running out of water. Obviously nowhere near as bad as what the islands have been over on King and Flinders, but it's things that people hadn't experienced before. You know, their water holes were getting very dry, which meant that, you know, they're having to put their foot valves in further and trying to keep the water up to the stock. And now this will put a bit of volume back into the dams and will help a lot.
So what does this actually mean for the animals as well, just having that extra grass, the extra moisture in the ground that they're on?
Oh, look, it'll certainly start to grow some feed. Obviously, when it rains, it doesn't rain feed. we've got to give the ground a little bit of time to recover from the dry period. But, you know, we've had it very, very dry, and there's a lot of seed on the ground from, you know, the dry period. So hopefully we'll get a good germination from the autumn rain, and that'll make a big difference to the feed, hopefully give us a bit of a feed bank going into winter, because a lot of people have used a lot of their fodder already. It wasn't a very good fodder year last year. And ABC on top of that, people have had to use it very early. So this may give them a bit of a relief coming into winter.
People have spoken to us over the last few months about just how dry it's been, and obviously that takes a mental toll as well. What kind of impact does it have when you do get a sudden downpour? You do see some of those dry conditions begin to break.
Oh, look, it's got to be great for the farmers. This morning's the first morning. I went and loaded some cattle to head off to Smithton this morning on a semi-trailer, and it's the first morning I've actually worked in mud for a long time. So, and the farmers that I was loading their cattle off this morning were very relieved. So,
and how do the dry conditions we have been experiencing, how have they fared compared to previous years you've seen, and how are you feeling now heading into winter?
It's an interesting thing, because the last 5 or 6 years we've had remarkable seasons. We really haven't had anywhere near the distance of dry that we've had this time. So the timeline that we've had the dry for has been a long time. We did get a bit of relief in January, which was really good, but that didn't sort of, we didn't get the follow up. But it's certainly longer than what it has been before. So obviously if we can get a bit of feed out of this, it will make it a lot easier for people coming into winter. But as you know, as it starts to get cold, people still do need some sort of fodder, whether it be hay or silage. So even though this will grow a bit of grass, that's not necessarily a big positive. We still need other stuff to go with it.
So you're not fully out of the woods just yet, but it is a good step?
It's a good step in the right direction, yeah.
And Tom Hoffing Farms out at Jim Plains, they received 22 meals last night. Meg Whitfield spoke to him this morning to get a little update.
Yeah, we had 22 mil of rain at the first farm, Jim's Plains, where I live just out of Smithton. We had 45. I talked to another fella at Orangetown. He had 38. And, yeah, just the roundabout, most of it was around about your 25-odd mil. Tema had 25.
And you mentioned you had a little bit of rain recently as well.
Yeah, we had rain last week. We had 13 mil out here at Jim's, which has made everything sort of green up. But this rain we've had overnight there, it's really kicked things into gear here. As long as it stays warm and we can keep getting the follow-up rains, hopefully we should be right for a while.
What have conditions looked like on your property at the moment? How dire were things getting?
Oh, yeah, the flat parts weren't too bad. You know, they still had that tinge of green, but we've been feeding hay pretty much flat out for the last 3 weeks. Trying to keep condition on the steers because it's hard trying to get cattle into, killable cattle into the abattoirs. They're that full up, trying to, keep other stock from going back in condition. So it's sort of, we've had to hold on extra stock while it's been dry.
And this rain that has come through, is it actually sticking around? Is it actually soaking into the ground or is it running straight off?
No, it's really soaked into the ground, this rain has. Yeah. So, it was a good soaking rain, this one.
And you mentioned particularly at about 4 this morning you awoke to the sound of plenty of rain.
Yeah, where I live there, it just absolutely teemed. Yeah, I hadn't heard a rain like that for a long time. Yeah, when you sort of don't hear it for a while, it's a godsend. Yeah.
And have you spoken to many other farmers around this morning? How are they feeling about the sudden downpour?
Oh yeah, it's put a spring into everyone's step. So hopefully, like I said, if we can keep getting follow up rains and warmer weather, we should be able to grow, get a decent autumn out of it. Hopefully, yeah.
I know people can be a bit apprehensive to actually use the word drought and talk about conditions being that dry. Were you facing drought conditions? Has this been enough to break that, to take that edge off?
A drought, we don't know what a drought is. Drought is really here, I know it wasn't a good spring and through the summer, but, different parts, places did have a bit of rain, but the thing is everyone's stocked up with a lot more cattle now and, the worst thing is there's not the fodder about. That's the biggest problem at the moment. Or if there's fodder about, it's virtually too dear to buy now. Yeah, it's just one out of the bag. We've probably been spoilt. We've probably had 2 or 3 good years before this. And, you farm for the good times, not the bad times. So, hopefully we, like I said, if we keep getting rain and a bit of... plenty of warmth in the ground there, we should be pretty right, hopefully.
And keeping the positive news coming, Tom Hoffing's good mood was matched by young Northwest farmer Caitlin Radford after Moriarty received between 42 and 44 mils of rain over the past 24 hours. And while it doesn't mean the farm is totally out of the woods just yet, it has meant a boost for dams and a chance to restore the cracks that were appearing in the ground. Reporter Meg Whitfield chatted to Caitlin today about what difference the rain is already making.
It's making a huge difference. Everyone was getting obviously quite nervous with how dry it was and coming to the end of our irrigation scheme season as well. It was getting a little bit nerve-wracking, but it's been really great. All of our soil moisture profiles have filled right back up, which puts us in good stead for all of our winter grass and winter breaker crops to come up ahead of next season.
What were things looking like? How dry has it been compared to previous summers or springs that you've gone through?
This is the driest I've known it to be this late. There was massive cracks in the ground, even trying to keep, potatoes that were waiting to be harvested, we're having to you know, keep water on them so that the grubs aren't getting in. And it's been a struggle to sort of keep fodder crops going for sheep as well, because we've been trying to focus all of our water on our vegetables to get them through to the end of the season. So, yeah, it's definitely been a bit of a tricky end to the season, that's for sure.
And the rain that you did get this morning and overnight, is that actually soaking into the ground? Is it sticking around?
Yeah, no, it looks really great. Obviously, where the ground's very hard, it tended to sort of sit on top of the ground a little bit, but it was a beautiful soaking rain that started sort of in the evening yesterday and has only just finished this morning. So we were really lucky there was no really heavy patches of rain that looks like they've done any damages from what we can see so far.
And have you had much of a chance to actually go out and assess it fully, or are you waiting until it dries up a little bit to avoid the mud?
Yeah, we're just going to give it the day and see what happens. We're just wanting to see if any more comes yet or not. From the radar, it looks like most of it's passed. But, yeah, no, we'll see what happens over the next couple of days. And obviously that ground's got to soak it all up, and then we can get out there and start working some new paddocks.
And you mentioned it's good just for your water supplies overall, boosting up some of – was it your water tanks you said had a bit of a boost, or where has that water gone outside of actually onto the land?
Yeah, well, it's helped fill our dams up for sure. Tanks as well that we've got on sheds, that's been really, really fantastic. You know, even just house water and things like that, we've been really grateful for that rain. But mainly seeing that hopefully anything that has run off has gone into the dams so that we can catch that ahead for winter and make sure our dams are full ahead of next season later in the year.
And what kind of break does this actually give you going into winter? What kind of pressure does it take off your shoulders?
Look, it definitely helps, but I think we're a long way until we're out of the red yet. You know, this one rain has been really fantastic, but we still need a lot more. So, you know, if we get another couple of good rains in the next few weeks would be ideal. Otherwise, this rain's just going to sort of not evaporate, but be used up very quickly. So if it's just more of a matter of keeping the profile full now.
And have you spoken to any other farmers around the area today? What have they been saying?
Not too much. I've been talking to my parents this morning. It's been very good for everything that Dad's had going as well. He's been lucky that it hasn't affected anything so far. I'm still waiting on some potatoes to come out as well. So on the potato side of things, we're nervous that it's not going to get too wet and then spuds are going to rot and we can't get them out. So there's kind of a catch side to rain on as well. Farmers are never happy. It's never going to be 100% perfect. You always want rain on some paddocks and not on others, but at the end of the day, we'll take whatever rain we can get at the moment.
And what are plans for the farm in the coming months? Do you have much produce in the ground already? What is it kind of looking like for the next couple of months for you?
Yeah, well, we've still got beans and Brussels sprouts and some potatoes in the ground that need to be harvested. So the sprouts will come out in May. The beans will be out sort of in the next 10 days. So that's sort of finished them off. And we've just planted grass and some breaker crops ahead of potatoes and other crops for next season. So it'll get all of those guys going, and hopefully we can keep them going from there on in.
And that was Moriarty's Caitlin Radford talking to reporter Meg Whitfield about the rain. Now let's turn to a contentious issue within the dairy industry that's been bubbling away for decades. And if you don't like listening to stories about livestock management, including the processing of bobby calves, you might want to just switch off. But bobby calves are unwanted male dairy calves, and there are fears farmers will have to euthanize thousands of these animals on farm come spring. That's because TAS Quality Meats, the state's only abattoir licensed to process calves, lost its license to do that last year. Meg Powell has the story.
Twice in his life, semi-retired farmer Gary Carpenter has had to shoot his own cows.
Up until the first time, I would have never done it. I used to get one of my staff to do it, and in the finish we had a bad outbreak or something, and you know, you didn't know how many you was going to shoot today. I took it on myself. It's not a pleasant job. It's not something that you just think you're going to be brave and go out and do. It emotionally, it does knock you about. It's you know, I know my wife was concerned when I was doing it back years ago. It's not yesterday, it's 20 odd years ago. Was concerned about my mental health back at that time. So, you know, it's got to stress to farmers that if you're not comfortable treating or euthanising your calves, don't force your staff to do it. Find somebody else that can do it for you, and you know, don't put yourself in that place where it could do harm to you later on.
This autumn, it will happen again, although his young share farmer will be shouldering the heartbreaking burden.
Yeah, we're euthanising calves now as we speak, basically. We'll keep all the heifers and the bull calves will be euthanised. Oh, look, it's just a waste. It's just a waste, and it's I don't know whether it makes you callous at the end of the day, or you lose a few feelings for your livestock. It's not something that farmers, you know, want to do and need to do. It's a necessity at present, and that's in the unfortunate part. And I don't think it's something you ever get used to doing.
Gary is one of many across Tasmania who was left in the lurch when Tasmanian Quality Meats lost its licence to export calves. That happened after secret footage taken inside the facility by animal activists was published last December. It was the only slaughterhouse in the state taking surplus dairy or bobby calves.
Euthanizing calves is probably just the only option for a lot of farmers this autumn. There's two methods. One's with a rifle. You can, if you're licensed and have a firearm license, you can use a rifle to put a calf down, or a captive bolt. Captive bolt is probably might be the more not so much easier way. It's the same sort of principle. It's like a small handgun to a certain degree, with a small bullet in it that does the same. You know, the end is the same. Meg, when you really think about farmers in general, and you could say 99.9% want to look after their animals as best as they can, you can do two things. You can bury or you can compost. So it's not a pleasant thought for farmers to have, Meg, in their mind that, you know, that calf, I've got to put it down basically as soon as practical and dispose of it some way. But it's better than rearing those cattle out with no end game either, that you don't know where and what you're going to do with them.
About 5% of Tasmania's calves are born in autumn. Later in the year, tens of thousands of surplus calves will be born, and at the moment, they have nowhere to go. That makes Tas Farmers Chair Ian Saw pretty nervous.
It's the down season. The big flush of bobby calves will come during the springtime, and that's what is worrying us at the moment. You know, I'm very, very confident that those farmers will do the right thing. I mean, but I don't think the public need to worry about the animal welfare issues on farm. The dairy farmers don't want to see cruelty, and they never have done, nor will they.
The situation has left people like Dr. Ellen Jungman, an animal welfare expert from the University of Melbourne, saying it's time to move away from killing off bobby calves.
To transport calves at 5 to 10 days of age to an abattoir is quite a, for example, such a vulnerable animal is quite a big imposition and brings risks to animal welfare. So in a lot of ways, yes, it would be more humane to kill animals to spare them that sort of destiny and have them killed on farm humanely. From an ethical point of view, of course, that seems quite difficult in terms of, you know, should we then breed animals and then kill them as soon as they're born? And so ethically, and it would be much better if we can actually make use of them and do something else with them, so they provide meat at a later age. And so if we can use them to grow out. There is a real move away because there is an understanding that perhaps killing animals at 5 to 10 days of age is not a great solution. And so there is a move away in the dairy industry, for example, to use sex semen. So the reason why we have so many milk calves that are surplus is that cows need to have a calf every year to produce milk. And half of those calves normally are male and half of those are female. And the females are used to replace the herd as older calves cows leave, then young calves take over. But the bobby calves, the male calves, have no function. And so there is a move towards using sexed semen to make sure that they do have female calves. But there's only so many calves then that you actually need. You only need so many females to replace your cows as well. And so what also is being used more is using meat breeds, things like Wagyu or other meat breeds to use on some of the cows as well, because then the resulting calves can be used for meat.
But that's not something that can be done in a hurry. And in these dry conditions, farmers don't want any extra mouths to feed. Dr. Jungman says she really empathises.
Of course, it must be really hard. Some of the farms, particularly some of the bigger farms, they may have to face killing hundreds of male bobby calves in maybe a period of 4 or 5 weeks. And that must be terrible. It's often a terrible thing for farmers to actually make that decision and euthanize animals. And we often underestimate how much mental strain that we then put on those farmers as well, having to do this. It might be good for the welfare of the calf. It might be the best thing to do for the calf, but it's not always, you know, the best thing to do for the welfare of the farmer. That's something you shouldn't forget either.
And that was Ellen Jungman, Senior Research Fellow for the Animal Welfare Science Centre at the University of Melbourne, ending that report from Meg Powell. Now, for 20 years, Jane Huntington has run 2 metre tall, a two-person craft beer brewery in Tasmania. She's one of an estimated 650 independent craft breweries scattered across Australia, following a boom in the industry over the past decade. But the boom might be over, with over 20 businesses having either closed or entering voluntary administration over the past year as they face higher costs, a drop in customers, and increased competition with supermarkets. Clancy Balin reports.
In Tasmania's Derwent Valley, Jane Huntington and her husband Ashley from 2 metre tall brewery have just finished their hops harvest.
The harvest's been, it's been a tough year, been very dry, very drought conditions. We're really hoping and praying for an autumn break.
You've been running this business for 20 years. You almost preempted the craft beer boom. Can you tell me about how the past 12 months have been for you and what's behind some of the challenges that have been facing the industry?
I think there has been a huge explosion in the craft beer scene at the small end of the market. Craft beer, independent craft beer, has been one of the fastest growing categories, and the big guys have been feeling the pinch. So the big guys have been trying to emulate and create a craft beer scene, but really we know that it's a big business behind it. So the consumer's got to be very savvy in understanding who's really behind the beer that they're drinking. Is it just a big multinational or not? But yes, there is a lot of competition out there. There's a lot of IPAs, a lot of all of these craft beers in cans. Now, I think the challenge is we've got huge rising costs. For example, our cost of goods that goes into a carton of beer is caps, labels, bottles, cartons. That's doubled in the last probably 18 months to 2 years. Huge challenges. Freight costs are much bigger. Getting our products into the marketplace are much more expensive. And of course, we can't keep putting our prices up. We've got to compete in a marketplace. There's also been the fact, I think, that with COVID, there's a lot of businesses that have sort of mistakenly thought there was going to be a real rise in consumer confidence and market forces. We were going to do a lot better coming out of COVID than we have. Inflationary pressures on small business have been huge. Couple that with the fact that the ATO have not been that friendly when they've been offering payment plans for some of those businesses paying their excise debts. They've got themselves into a little bit of trouble, and we've seen quite a few voluntary administrations happening and a few closures. I think it's just the pressure of business is really, really tough at the moment.
It sort of sounds like a perfect storm of difficult circumstances.
It is a perfect storm, and in the 20 years that we've been here, I've not seen all of those market forces of inflationary pressure and cost of living crisis, as well as a drought. So, you know, huge pressures.
Just up the road, Australia's largest hops grower, Hop Products Australia, is also finishing up their harvest, but they aren't feeling the same pressures.
My name is Adrian Jankulovic, Tasmanian and New Zealand sales rep. We're obviously into the full swing of harvest now. Things are looking good. Harvest is looking fantastic and, yeah, we're all rolling.
There have also been reports that it's been a tough time for some small-scale or medium-scale brewers. Have you felt that pinch yourself?
We've noticed it for sure. Obviously, we work really closely with all of our customers and our brewers. We've certainly noticed that there have been some tougher times, like there have been for every household in Australia with increased cost of living pressures across the board. That does affect every business, and breweries aren't immune.
Has the price of hops increased? Like when you're selling it to your customers, is it being sold at a higher price?
No, we try to make sure that we are consistent with our pricing, in line with what customers are used to seeing. Like, naturally, there are going to be price increases as costs of goods increase. Manufacturing, labour, that is consistently going up. So, you know, we feel that. Breweries feel that. Every business feels that. We do our absolute best to try not to pass on that cost, because we understand that consistency is key, not among quality alone, but also price. So for us, we tend to remain the same where we can.
The Independent Brewing Association believes Tasmanian brewers are in a better position than their mainland counterparts.
John Burridge, and I'm the Tasmanian State Chapter Lead for the IBA, Independent Brewers Association. We've got some breweries that are defying the trend, and through great local community impact, engagement, they've actually been growing, which you don't see too often at this period.
Why are there some that are doing quite well when others are sort of feeling the pinch?
I think when you look at there's no rhyme or reason. Some of the indicators I have seen are their engagement with their local community, really honing in on their clientele.
Interesting. I guess, you know, Tassie isn't alone in feeling this pinch amongst the independent brewers. This is happening on the mainland as well, of course. Do you know if Tassie is in a better position than other states and jurisdictions, or is it all relatively the same across the country?
Look, I think Tasmania is in a better position. I have the privilege of travelling around other states and seeing their beer economy. And I think Tasmania is lucky in the fact they've got a fantastic support base of people that want to actually purchase independent Tasmanian beer, which I would say at an estimated amount, the independent beer volume in Tasmania would be around about the 15-16% mark. Whereas in other states, I would estimate it to be down around the, you know, 5% mark. There's an expectation of growth given what we've achieved over the past, you know, 6, even 10 years. And whilst we're not achieving that now, it's definitely not alarm stations. It's not the best news. We're not seeing the growth like we used to, but, you know, there's still optimism out there. I think the beer quality is still exceptional. There's still new breweries in the pipeline. I mean, a new brewery opened up in Bishano about 2-3 months ago. And there's definitely plans for more in the future. I think they are just holding to see this little downturn in the market shift through, and then onwards and upwards.
Clancy Bayland speaking with John Burridge, the Tasmanian rep for the Independent Brewers Association. And just before the news headlines, we've got a text: 78 mills at Golden Valley, which is just between Westbury and Golden Creek. 78 mills of rain up there. And that was from Nigel. Thank you, Nigel, for that text. And if you've got any other rainfall figures you'd like to give us, send us a text: 0438922936. Time for the news headlines now with Michael Dallafontana.
Thanks, Fiona. The World Central Kitchen says reports members of its team in Gaza, including an Australian aid worker, have been killed is distressing. Palestinian medical officials say an Israeli airstrike killed 4 international aid workers and their Palestinian driver. Israel's Defence Force says it's conducting a thorough review. Meanwhile, France has proposed a draft United Nations Security Council resolution that seeks options for possible UN monitoring of a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. It's also put forward proposals to help the Palestinian Authority assume greater responsibilities in the Strip. Guatemala's immigration authorities say 3 flights carrying over 350 deported migrants have arrived in Guatemala City from the US. Guatemalan officials say the US has deported more than 19,000 people back to the Central American country so far this year. Last year, fewer than 11,500 were returned to Guatemala. And the peak body for exercise is calling on the federal government to offer tax incentives to help people become more active and healthy. It wants exercising, including gym memberships, to be tax deductible. The Treasury is putting together the federal budget, which will be unveiled next month. A full bulletin of ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Michael. Now to go to the Weather Bureau, and we've got Jenny Horvat. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Now, give us an update of rainfall overnight.
Yeah, so we've had that rain band come in from the northwest. So up till 9 a.m. So these are the 24-hour totals. The highest we saw around was around Western Creek, where they picked up just over 86 millimetres of rain. Around Sheffield, we picked up around 65 millimetres. Where else have we got? Derwent picking up around 54 millimetres. Devonport also just under 50 millimetres. Burnie around 47. So quite a bit around sort of the north there, and not quite up in the far northwest there. King Island missing out this time. That band just sat to the east as it's come across, and it's continued to make its way across the state and more through central and now across eastern parts at the moment. So since 9 a.m. We've seen places picking up a good nearly 10 millimetres, Grindstone 9 millimetres there, Flinders Island around 8 millimetres, Hobart's picked up 8 millimetres, but since pre-9 a.m. it picked up nearly 10 millimetres. So it's a bit tricky with some of the central and eastern ones there, because we've got the pre-9 a.m. and now we're going to have to add the post-9 a.m. Fiona.
Still doing that.
Yes, and it's still raining in parts.
Exactly. It sounds like it's just travelling down the state and across the state.
Yes, exactly.
Well, can you tell me what the outlook is?
Yeah, so we've got this band clearing sort of the southeast and east at the moment, but it is followed by some showers pushing up in a bit of a west-southwesterly flow. So we are starting to see those showers coming across the northwest and the western coast as well. So there'll be a bit of a gap for people after the rain clears, but looks like we could see some more showers again pushing statewide during the afternoon. But as we head into the evening, we will start to see those showers easing back and just some light showers remaining around the west and far south on the Wednesday, and possibly lingering around the northeast, including the Furneaux Islands as well, but looks like it will be drying out elsewhere. And again on Thursday, with a ridge of high pressure maintaining a bit of a ridge, a little bit of a light westerly flow. So again, a little bit of light shower activity across the west, and couldn't rule a little bit still lingering up in the northeast as well. And again on Friday, just some showers lingering, light ones up around the north. It starts to get a little bit interesting as we head into the weekend. Looks like there might be a low pressure system developing in the Tasman, so we'll see whether that comes down a little bit, but we could see those showers in the northeast increasing on the Saturday and maybe extending along the east coast. But a bit of a watch this space with that one there, Fiona.
Okay, any warnings?
Okay, so we have cancelled some of our warnings, but we've still got our marine warnings for the gale warning, which is current for northern and eastern and southern waters, and that's from Sandy Cape to South East Cape, but not including Banks Strait and Franklin Sound and upper South East Coast. We also have that strong wind warning current for Banks Strait and Franklin Sound, upper East Coast and western waters from South East Cape to Sandy Cape, and for all southeast inshore coastal waters. We also do have a warning today with for the sheep grazies for the southeast coast with the rain there, and those southwesterly winds could be a little bit fresh and gusty as well.
Can you tell me about coastal waters and swell?
Sure thing. So looking at the waters, for the moment, we're seeing them shifting. So starting off sort of northwest to westerly, 15 to 25 knots, and we're seeing them shift west to southwesterly from the west, 20 to 30 knots, and we'll see that throughout during the course of the afternoon. And we could see those winds picking up to 35 to 40 knots at times across the northeast and southeast. So swells we're looking at in west and south there, southwesterly 2 to 3 metres, across the northwesterly around a metre, and out east there's a little bit of a northeasterly 1 to 2 metres, as well as a southerly swell pushing up there of 1 to 1.5 metres, tending southwesterly 1.5 to 2.5 metres offshore. And currently the Cape Sorrel wave rider buoy is reading 1.7 metres with a maximum wave height of 2.8 metres.
Thank you very much, Jenny. We'll catch you again tomorrow.
No worries. Thanks, Fiona.
Miriam Margulies, hello.
Dear Joel, what a lovely introduction.
Afternoons with Joel Reinberger.
Do you enjoy the kind of frank and filthy reputation you've earned for yourself?
I hope that there's something more to me besides filth, but sometimes I doubt it.
How did your more conservative parents handle your persona?
They loathed it. They thought it was disgusting. But I'm afraid as I got older and more independent, I followed
Joel Reinberger,
my own filth.
On the ABC Listen app.
Weekdays from 1:30, ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
One of Australia's largest wine producers, Brown Brothers, is confident they'll be able to immediately secure sales into China following the lifting of tariffs. Brown Brothers has vineyards in Tasmania's north and east, as well as several farms in Victoria's northeast and central region. Brown Brothers winemaker Catherine Brown says getting back into this market won't be easy, but she's optimistic.
We're absolutely elated as a business and a whole industry to have these tariffs lifted on China. It's been a huge burden on the whole industry since 2020 with these imposed tariffs. So to now give us the freedom to be able to move back into China and put a focus back into that market will be really important for all of us.
What proportion of your sales at Brown Brothers was going towards the Chinese market?
It was our second biggest export market, and we actually have three full-time employees on the ground there in China. So something that we've done is actually kept those employees in the China market, and we're with the optimism that this was going to happen and that the market will open up again. So we really feel that we can get back into China, essentially running the fact that we've already got that team there to get Australian wine and get Brown Brothers wine back on the tables of the Chinese consumers.
That does sound quite optimistic, keeping that team on the ground in China. But how have they gone, you know, keeping up those contacts?
Yeah, they've done a really good job of being able to continue a small amount of momentum. While these tariffs were imposed, there were a few Australian wine products that were still able to be sold in that market, including sparkling wine. So there's been a small amount of sparkling wine from us moving into that market with that team on the ground being able to focus on that.
And so have you gotten any more orders? Have you been hearing anything else from your Chinese contacts?
Yeah, so when we had the interim announcement about 2 weeks ago, we really felt that the momentum really started again and the market really getting excited. So there's a few orders in the pipeline, which is really exciting. And our CEO has just been over there in the market last week to be over there rebuilding those contacts. So this announcement couldn't come at a better time for us.
And are you expecting demand to rebound to pre-tariff levels?
I would love to say yes, but I think we would be absolute dreamers to think that. Since 2020, the consumer market has changed so much in China for their desire for wine in general, but also the fact that they just haven't had Australian wine out there to be purchased. It's really changed the look of the market. So we're really going to have to be creative and look at things a bit differently when going back into the market, and even understanding that there's new consumers. There's a few million people that were not legal drinking age 4 years ago. So to be able to go over there and work with this new group of wine consumers, and we're really excited about what we could potentially do.
What are you hearing from other winemakers in your region? Are they also as optimistic as you, or are they a bit more reserved in their excitement, I guess, off the back of this announcement?
I think we all have to be optimistic. This is a big positive for our industry. And really, for the past 4 years, Australia's been producing more wine than what they can sell or what our domestic customers can drink. So for this market to open up, we really have to look at the bright side of it, but also we have to understand that there's going to be a lot more hard work to be able to continue to sell the volume of wine that's in Australia at the moment. So looking at new markets, Southeast Asia, I think, is going to be a really important group of markets going forward. So hard work, but optimism really helps along the way.
Millawa-based Brown Brothers winemaker Catherine Brown speaking there. Time for a little break now with Eskimo Joe.
Slap the days. It's like
And that was Eskimo Joe and From the Sea. Now, the oyster industry is working hard to develop shellfish that are resistant to disease, but also attractive to the consumer. Growers pay a fee to an industry breeding program that is currently testing different families of oysters in waters right around the state. Nick Griggs is the Australian seafood industry's breeding program coordinator. He says some families of oysters are definitely stronger and more attractive than others.
We're grading the 22 year class to look for uniformity of growth and look between each family to see how they're growing and the consistency of growth to get a better idea of how the families perform after POMS.
And you're trying to work out which ones are the strongest, I suppose?
Yes, so POMS is still definitely in the background, but now we're looking at more a TAS index, an economic index, where we're looking at weighing up the different traits, commercial traits as well as resistant to POMS, and part of that is how uniform the oysters are when they're graded and grown. A grower would like to have an idea of how his stock's going to perform as they're moving through the production cycle. So these oysters we're growing at the moment are 18 months old, and they've all been housed at commercial densities in a commercial manner. Now we're seeing how they've grown, and then we can recommend to industry, we can suggest, I should say, which families we think they should use, and then they take those recommendations up and breed with them for the future of the industry. So these oysters will be used commercially by some hatcheries this year once we release them at Easter.
So are you seeing, I mean, you're only just having a little look today, are you seeing any particular families that are doing better than others?
Most definitely. There's units that are three quarters full and there's units that are still at a quarter full from where they're stocked, and it's just different growth rates and different families behaving different in different environments. So it's just exciting to see, having the opportunity to grow them out more. Traditionally we'd hand the oysters over at 12 months based on POMS. So the selective breeding was based around the EBV for POMS and how they survived the POMS trial from that year of SPAT. Now that we've got to 80%, the POMS is still definitely there. With St Helens we saw this year, that the mortality event. So we're definitely not taking our eye off the ball, but we need to think about commercial traits and finding what's best for the farmers and talking to farmers about shape, shell, condition of meat, and what they want in the characteristics, as well as POM's resistance.
It's pretty exciting to sort of move forward into looking at some of those marketing and traits as well.
It's a continuation of the work that was done in 2014-2015 by industry, by ASI for industry. And then when POMs came along, that was definitely cut back. We focused on breeding for resistance because no one wants a dead oyster. Everyone wanted oysters. So now we're focusing, under the guidance of Henry Hewish, to look at more commercial traits and think about what we're doing and moving forward, coming up with a bigger plan and a more strategic oyster, as well as POMs resistance.
So obviously there's POMs in St Helens at the moment. From an ASI perspective, what are you seeing there, and what do you, is there any sort of positive news?
At the moment, we've moved some of our stock from our biosecure hatchery at IMAS in Taroona to Smithton to grow them out to then move trials into St Helens. So when we were looking to move stock into St Helens, there was floods going on and other bits and pieces, and it was just too risky to put out a scientific trial with confidence that our family lines were not affected by the environment. We've made the decision to move them to Smithton, which is a first time in a long time. I think 2014 was the last time oysters were sent to Smithton from ASI. So we've moved 67 families to Smithton, and then we'll grade those and then deploy them into trials into St Helens and also trials in Smithton. So we can get an idea of how different bays are growing and get a bigger picture of what the industry wants and needs based on different bays. It's not just Pittwater, Pipe Clay, Little Swanport, Boomer Bay, where we've been heavily focused because of POMs.
We've heard that there's a few issues, quite serious issues, at Pipe Clay Lagoon. Do you see some sort of input from ASI in the future to try and sort that out or to try and help at Pipe Clay Lagoon?
So we were approached by growers in Pipe Clay Lagoon to see what we could do. So we sat down and we've put in a small trial here with our family lines for the 2023 year class. That consists of having three replicates paced around the bay to see how the oysters grow and survive, first off, to see if our family lines will grow and continue to grow and what growth they'll put on compared to the other growing areas that we're holding oysters. So that's the first port of call. Then we're looking to work with growers and see what tests they want. So we're collecting some algae samples for the next 4 weeks, and we're also looking for nitrogen for the next 4 weeks. We're just here to help.
And that was Nick Griggs. He's with the breeding program with the Australian Seafood Industries, talking there about oysters. Now, Vespa the Black Labrador has been awarded the 2024 New South Wales Service Dog Award at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. The six-year-old Labrador made 739 interceptions at Sydney's International Airport last year, a record among biosecurity sniffer dogs. David Claughton met Vespa and her handler, Perry Carrett, at the Royal Easter Show.
Vespa is one of our biosecurity detector dogs, and she primarily works at Sydney Airport and Mail Centre, and she just has a massive personality. She loves what she does, and she makes every day enjoyable for me.
A black Labrador?
Black Labrador, yes.
And how old is she?
Vespa is 7 years old.
Oh, wow. So she's been on it for quite a while, yeah?
Yeah, she's experienced. She's a pro at her job by now.
Right. And so she's won a category here for service dog. Just explain a bit about that if you can.
So Vespa's been nominated based on the work that she does for biosecurity. So she has had many successful detections over the past year, and so over that period I was Vespa's primary handler, so I had the pleasure with working with her every day, and she kept me very busy.
So what are the kinds of things that Vespa's detected?
So our dogs are trained to find a variety of different target odours, predominantly things sort of like food items or plant material, animal-based products. Plants, seeds, bulbs.
It's surprising
meat.
What comes in.
Yeah, there's a massive quantity of things that they're looking for. So
I saw a note there about her detecting foot and mouth disease. So that's come in on a product somewhere, yeah?
So foot and mouth disease can be carried in a range of commodities. In particular, our dogs are looking for products like meat or dairy that have a risk of carrying this virus within them.
But that's one, you know, a disease that if it got out into the Australian herd could shut down the whole beef industry. That could be a massive, massive problem. So this is really a remarkable thing. And she's picked up other things as well, that your, or other products that have had disease that could threaten our industry as well. So just talk to me about what's her daily routine.
Yeah, so a day at work for Vespa. She arrives in the morning. She's always ready to go. And then she has a busy day screening passengers at the airport. We like to sneak in a little bit of a play and a pat and a bit of a treat here and there in between her busy work. But she loves what she does. She's always eager to go. And then she chuffs off in the afternoon for a bit of a snooze at the kennels. All right. And yeah, a bit of a pat.
So the average day would go for like an 8 or 10 hour day with her?
Her average day, she's would be at work for around 5 or so hours.
Right.
Yeah.
And how much longer has she got? Like at 7, she could, I suppose she could do a few more still?
Yeah, so Vespa will be due to retire soon. So she's probably got about 12 more months of work. And
oh,
then,
it's not much longer to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's our major weapon in biosecurity, though. I can't afford to let her go just in 4 months.
Yeah, she's doing well. She still loves what she does. She's always excited to come to work. So I think it'll be a bit of a shock for her when she goes into retirement.
What happens in retirement for biosecurity dogs?
So our detector dogs are rehomed in a loving family once they retire. Generally, that is with one of their former handlers. And I certainly have a spot on my couch ready for Vespa. So
she's coming to you. Is that decided yet?
Oh, that's my plan anyway.
And in terms of the work with the dogs, like how significant are they from a biosecurity perspective, do you reckon?
Yeah, our dogs have an incredible impact. They're such a diverse tool for us. They have the ability to be mobile and they can detect things that many of our other systems don't have the reach for. So our dogs are able to be deployed across a variety of different settings, which is part of what makes them so valuable.
Mm. How many are there, do you know, in the service?
I believe in Sydney at the moment we have about 24 dogs working for us, although it is a national program, so there are many more working across the country.
Yeah.
In the works at the moment, they're recruiting around 20 new detector dogs and handlers to help facilitate the screening of incoming loads of passengers and mail across all different ports in Australia.
Yeah. And what is it about Labradors, do you think, that makes them good detector dogs?
Well, a Labrador is always a bit of a people pleaser, so they're keen to do the job, but they just want to do it to please their human. They also have an incredible nose. They've been bred for their nose and their detection abilities. They're very sociable creatures as well, so it makes them great for the airports where they're around people all of the time.
So in the cargo side, would they be working on ships or inspecting containers in terminals?
Yeah, so in cargo, the detector dogs have more of an open search sequence, so they can search on containers and areas like that. Searching for a variety of different pest and diseases, including brown marmorated stink bug, which can come in on those sorts of means.
Is she the first dog to compete in this way at a show? Like, it's kind of funny to think of those of biosecurity dogs involved in the show itself.
Yeah, I believe that she is our first dog to receive such an award, so it's a wonderful recognition of all of the work that service dogs as well as our detector dogs do and the training that goes into getting them up to scratch and the important work they do to help protect Australia's ecosystems.
And that's Perry Corrett, who works as a dog handler for the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry. And on average, detector dogs intercept up to 45,000 risk items nationally each year. And they are all Labradors, according to the department. Now, good afternoon, Joel Reinberger.
Hello there, Fiona. How are you doing?
Very good today. Thank you.
Did you actually get some time off and some shut-eye over the weekend?
Oh, yes, yes. But not much shut-eye, I must admit. Lots of activities. It was such beautiful weather.
Oh, very nice. I spent a lot of it in the kitchen, just making nice things for
lovely.
The family. Yeah, yeah, really nice. There's a roast lamb that's a favourite in the family where you roast it and you slice it off the bone and you make this incredible gravy of red wine and red currant jelly and mint and soy sauce and brown sugar and then you cook it in the gravy for another couple of hours.
In a slow cooker or?
No, just no. in the stove, in a pot in the stove. It's an incredible
it just
thing.
It must fall apart then.
Yeah, yeah. And the red wine goes pretty much black because it's just so rich, the stuff. It's fantastic.
Good.
So anyway, what's coming up on the show? Now, we're going to talk to this Tasmanian artist and author, and I love this from her book launch PR. The Nights by Helen Hopcroft is an erotic retelling of 1001 Nights. The novella will be launched at Leader Gallery with a pop-up exhibition of book illustrations.
Oh, dear. So, I'm sort of wondering what these illustrations are
going
to be.
Yeah, a pop-up. Erotic pop-ups. That's what we're all after in our lives, Fiona. So I'm going to talk to her. And she did that erotic retelling of 1001 Nights as a part of her PhD. So I'm absolutely fascinated to find out where she got this idea and what sort of erotic things are popping up.
Thank you, Joel Reinberger. I look forward to it. Join me tomorrow on the Country Hour at noon.
Subscribe to the ABC Radio Hobart e-newsletter today. You'll get exclusive content, a first peek at the latest competitions, and program highlights delivered straight to your inbox. Now. Subscribe to the ABC Radio Hobart e-newsletter today. You'll get exclusive content, a first peek